I guess he can hear us, so we're good. All right, we're going to do our prayers. Let's just take that moment that we always take at the beginning to let our minds come to rest. And I thought it was interesting that in his book, Mingyur Rinpoche says very early on in the book that before he goes to sleep every night, he does a body scan. So that's sort of what we do at the beginning. We don't really do a full scan, but we just bring our attention into our body. You know, it could start at the top of the head and just scan down to the soles of the feet, or just get a general gestalt overall feeling of what your body feels like right now. What it feels like to be in this body, on this seat, in this space, and this cyberspace, in this present moment of awareness. And in that alert, relaxed, receptive state of mind, we will do our prayers to set our motivation and generate some merit, collect some merit, and empower our practice by requesting the teaching. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon. This imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Dadan Simshan Tam Chelo Chisu Drawers in G Laptu Sol Chalam Du Drawers in G Laptu Sol Am Trilpa Sowers in G Laptu Sol Trilpa Yeshesu Charwars in G Laptu Sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu jin ke chubum dada mi ke nam dang droa kunji draki jitsam bar tam che ke du daki cha tento. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, if you have it printed out, then you can recite it along with me. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So I'm going to make you my co-host, Lamajin Tsang, as usual. And so Lamajin Tsang can help make sure everybody's voices are heard. So as always, just let me know, raise your hand, raise your virtual hand if you want to say something. And if you're not on video, as Joanne and Mark are not, then a virtual hand is good, or you can just unmute yourself and speak up at an appropriate gap, hopefully. So I just want to get a sense of how many people are taking the course. Okay, so a bit more than half. Okay, yeah, most of us. And everybody else has the book? Anybody not have the book or the course? Okay, because it would be fine if you were here without, you know, without either one of those. You can still enjoy the course. Yes, Lama Jinsong.
Because I want to make sure that Joanne and Mark, since I don't hear you, I just wanted to see where you guys were at. Are you taking the course? Or if not, do you have and are reading the books?
Yeah, this is Mark. I have a book and taking the course.
Okay, and Joanne?
Oh, we need to unmute her. Okay, you're unmuted, Joanne.
I am part of the course. I have
a book. Good. Great. Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sorry, I didn't see your hand. Okay.
Whose hand?
I see Joanne's. I mean, I don't know what I, okay.
Yeah, whatever. The world is full of uncertainty, as we know and have learned from Inger Miche's book.
Sorry.
So just to reiterate, though, you don't have to take the course. The course is an enrichment. And what it does is, if you're reading the book, you it's a little subtle if you're reading the book, but he's really taking us through the stages of the bardo, all the bardos, the six bardos, which we'll talk about more at the end, last part of class. In the course, that's what he does. He talks about each of the six bardos. But you can see as you're reading the book how closely interrelated it is with the content of the book. So taking the course is optional, but it is a really fabulous course if you have time. Okay, so anybody got anything to say before we plunge forward? Okay. Everybody's reading the book and most of us are taking the course. So this can be mostly like informal discussion, and we'll just see how it develops. I have a plan. First thing we're going to do is just talk about how it fits into our study of Ornament of Precious Liberation, because it does. We're going to do, so for meditation, we're going to meditate from the book. There's some really lovely meditations in the first few chapters of the book that we can apply to our own lives and our own formal meditation. So that's how we're going to do meditation today. And I thought that I might read some of the passages from the book.
Anne just joined us.
I saw. I thought I might read some passages, but if everybody's reading it, then that may not be necessary. So we'll talk about that. And, you know, we can just discuss it. All right. So first, let's see. I'm going to just mute you again, Lama Jinsong. I just wanted to talk about Ornament of Precious Liberation a little bit. It's been a while since we have convened to study Ornament of Precious Liberation. So just a very brief recap, and hopefully no one will go to sleep, but this is like really, I guess it's important to keep this context in mind, because this is not like a separate source, you know, course of study. It fits right into the path. This is just like an illumination of certain parts of the path, or the path itself. Mingyur Rinpoche is obviously pretty far ahead on the path, but he's very kindly lighting it up for us, like from really basic how you deal with things and how you apply meditation on up to how you go through dying, because he does that, as we know. So Ornament of Precious Liberation is the user's manual for the step-by-step path to awakening, written by Gampopa, one of the founders of the Kagyu lineage in the 12th century. And we're also studying Rangu Tulku's commentary / introduction, which he wrote, or teachings he gave to to help introduce the stages of the path through Ornament of Precious Liberation to Westerners, specifically for Westerners. So Ornament of Precious Liberation begins, as we all remember, with the three prerequisites. We could take a moment and see if we remember what those are, what three things we need in order to follow the path in the first place. And then those are the first three chapters of Ornament of Precious Liberation. So those are, in order of accessibility, Buddha nature, which everyone has in all the six realms. Precious human existence. Okay, that's the first thing that sort of cuts some beings out, quite like the vast majority of beings do not have the opportunity, the conditions to awaken in this lifetime. But we're very fortunate that we do. Just being here is like, by definition, we have the precious human existence. So that's our working basis. And the third thing we need is an authentic teacher. We all have connections with authentic teachers. And Gampopa himself is an authentic teacher. And he said that anyone who reads his book, who reads Ornament of Precious Liberation, it's like receiving a teaching in person from him, but also helps to have like living human teachers to help us sort things out as we go. So those are the three prerequisites. And so then next he addresses the four obstacles to awakening. And let's see if we remember what those are before I count them off. So the first one is being too attached to worldly activity, meaning too busy. Like our life is too full of things we have to do to be able to really travel the path. Second one is being too attached to distraction and pleasure. And that means that when we have free time, we waste most of our free time. So hopefully we don't have those. Hopefully we've all managed to carve out the time on a daily basis to study, contemplate, and meditate and travel the path to awakening. And if we don't have time, then those are the things we look at. Am I too busy? Like, are there things that I can get rid of in my responsibilities? Or when I have free time, what do I do with that? Third one being too attached to personal peace, which is just missing the love and compassion, missing the others first element, which is like mind training. And then fourth, not knowing how to wake up, which the book is a remedy for. So I'm just going to go through the table of contents, basically, so that we remember, just to refresh in our minds, like what this path is that we have spent a year going through so far, a year minus a couple of holiday and summer breaks. So the first few chapters are, the first few topics are the antidotes to the first three obstacles. So the obstacle of being too busy is antidoted by the understanding impermanence. So we always have to remember impermanence, and that is a lot of what this book is about. And the first section of the course is really about remembering impermanence and practicing with impermanence. Second, the suffering of samsara and karma and its effects are the antidote to being too attached to distraction and pleasure. If we remember that our action determines what's going to happen to us in the future, whether we're suffering or whether we're happy, and that through our actions we accumulate karma, then we will be motivated not to waste our time. Chapter 7, loving kindness and compassion, is the antidote to the third obstacle, being too attached to personal peace, your own personal path, your own personal meditation, and so forth. And then we get into the fourth. So the fourth obstacle is not knowing how to do it. All of the following chapters, you know, and starting from impermanence or the antidote to that, but especially kicks in with, like, the path kicks in at chapter eight, which is taking refuge. We take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and it's really important to remember that every day. That's why we recite the refuge prayer and the refuge in bodhicitta prayer as often as we can. That's our support for traveling the path, our example and our support, and the path itself. So then the two aspects of bodhicitta, aspiration bodhicitta, which we recited in the reminder at the beginning. I will wake up, and I will wake up specifically to help other beings wake up. And then action bodhicitta, which mostly consists of the six paramitas, which is the section that we've just almost finished. We're on the last paramita. So let's take a moment to see if we remember all of the six paramitas. Probably hard to do on the spot like this, but the first one is generosity. And, you know, we'll recall all the details. There's three kinds of generosity and so forth. If those things are not fresh in our minds, then it's really good to review the material because this is how we wake up. These are the actions through which we attain awakening, become Buddhas, fulfill our potential. So generosity, moral discipline, ethical conduct, skillful conduct is the second one. Third paramita is patience. Fourth paramita is diligence or joyful diligence or enthusiastic diligence, just sticking with it. Fifth one, which is the last one we finished, is meditation or meditative concentration. And we mostly learned about shamatha meditation. We were introduced to the idea of vipassana meditation, but mostly it's about perfecting or just becoming very familiar with shamatha or shine, calm abiding meditation. And that's how we learn to control our attention. And so when we get to the wisdom paramita, the sixth paramita, that's really about vipassana. That is about the next stage of meditation, which is learning to recognize the nature of mind. So let's see. So we all know the basic meaning of the paramita of wisdom or the perfection of wisdom because it's introduced in all the other paramitas. The first five paramitas are sort of the means of traveling the path, and wisdom, they become the means of traveling the path when we apply wisdom to them. So we can take a moment. Do we remember what the basic definition of wisdom is in the context of all the paramitas? And that is to remember that emptiness or lack of solid existence of every aspect of all of our experience in life and of all the paramitas. For example, when you're talking about generosity, there's no solid or fixed or permanent person who's giving, person who's receiving, or act of generosity. And that's the basic working definition of the wisdom paramita in the context of the other five paramitas, meaning that like no element, no situation, no element of the situation exists exactly in the way that we perceive it. So it's about learning to disengage from all of our preconceptions, opinions, judgments, concepts. It's a gradual process, and we get to watch Mingyur Rinpoche doing exactly this through the course of the book. So in Love with the World, Mingyur Rinpoche demonstrates how to do that almost moment by moment, how to disengage from experience that feels very solid, very frightening, very compelling, very real, very fixed, very vivid, how to take yourself out of that mindset of interpreting your experience as a solid, fixed thing. And that is, in fact, the cause of all of our suffering, as we have learned time and again in the teachings. So in the course, in Dying Every Day, Mingyur Rinpoche spells out for us how our experiences correspond to the various bardo states and how each moment of our existence is, in fact, a bardo state or an intermediate state, a gap, a temporary state. And then how to practice. So how it is a bardo and how to practice with that, and especially how to practice in this first section, how to practice with the bardo of this life to prepare ourselves for the final bardos, the bardos of dying, the great adventure of actually dying and being reborn. So that is synopsis. quote was helpful and not tedious, of where we are in Ornament of Precious Liberation and how in love with the world and dying every day fit in with that. We will definitely, after this module, we could call it, working with the book and the course, we'll talk about how we are going to finish the actual book of Ornament of Precious Liberation. So does anybody have any questions, comments, insights, anything to share? Do you want me to read passages from the book, or do you want to open it up to general discussion? Anybody? I'm going to unmute everybody just for a moment so we can just have a free-for-all. Okay, free-for-all. Any opinions?
Can we have both? Can we do, because yeah, we've got an hour and a half.
We have time. We have time. Yeah, Jinsung, you had something?
Well, I just, if we decided to share something, I had something to share.
Please. Well, please share something.
If that's all right.
But if you're going to jump ahead to something in a specific page in the book, maybe we'll take it a little by piece.
Yes.
And we will discuss.
That's so, what I was going to do. But it's okay. Something, I'll just tell you what it was, which is that the very last part of the reading, like pages 48 or whatever it was through 52, mm-hmm. where it says, you know, what will you do in the Bardug is a really fantastic explanation, like a definition of the term Bardo. So anyway, we'll go back later on.
We'll get to that. We're going to get to that. And okay. So I think Marilyn's suggestion is good. We'll start out reading a bit, and then we can just discuss each section. And we're going to spend some time on the meditations as well. So it's not going to be a lot of reading. Okay, anybody else have any input on that question? Everybody's okay with that plan? All right, so it will develop over the course of the next few classes how we're going to do this. What's the best way? All right, everybody is now muted again. But feel free to get our attention. Lama Jinsung, if you could keep an eye out on the screen. I can unmute
myself.
You.
Okay, so I do have, because we have the lovely huge crew here today with us. So what I do have is, because there's so many folks, I don't want to block your face, I have the panel open that shows mm-hmm. when someone's put their hand up. So at this point, if you just want to use your, computer hand or mechanical hand, whatever, I'll see that there's a hand raised anyway. Unfortunately, if I put it up with the names, I block out faces. So I don't really want to do that, but I'll do my best.
I didn't know there was such a panel.
Yeah, if you press down on, because that's the only way I figured, if you go to the bottom and it says, if you your cursor down and it comes up mm-hmm. with that and it says manage participants, then the panel will arise.
Oh, I see. That's what you mean by the panel. You see everybody or you just see a few?
Well, you can scroll down if you go to more.
Yeah, you have to scroll down, yeah.
So I've opened the whole thing to show everybody, but everybody's hands. But the thing is, I don't want to block anyone's face.
Yeah, I agree. We'll do our best. And if we're not seeing you, just jump right in.
Yeah, it's like this kind of thing also works. So do you want to mute me again?
I shall. Okay, we're all mute. Except for me, ha ha ha. Okay, so everybody's reading the book. So I was going to start out with the beginning of it, The Great Escape, but I don't think we need to do that. It was just, you know, if we'd had anybody who wasn't reading the book, it was to get them hooked in. But obviously that's already happened. Okay. And why he did it, I'm going to read the part about why he did it. And I want us to keep in mind, like in the 37 practices, there's a verse that pretty much everything in this book is about. So you can think about that. One of the practices of the Bodhisattva is epitomized or completely illustrated by this book. So he says, I had set my sights. Why is he doing the retreat? I had set my sights on following the ancient tradition of sadhus. The wandering...
Wait. What page are you on? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm on XI, if people are following along. Right towards the beginning of like the third page of the prologue. I had set my sights on following the ancient tradition of sadhus, the wandering Hindu ascetics who gave up who give up all their belongings to live free of worldly concerns. The earliest heroes of my own Tibetan Kagyu lineage had followed in the footsteps of their Hindu predecessors, taking shelter in caves and forest groves. I would die to my life as a privileged tulku, a recognized incarnation of a spiritual adept. I would discard the mantle of being the youngest son of Tulku Urgen Rinpoche, the esteemed meditation master. I would live without attendants and administrators and would exchange the protections granted by my role as abbot and lineage holder for the anonymity that I had never known but had long yearned for. So anybody got the 37 practices verse? Yes, yes, Chet, we're all... Yes, verse 2, to leave my homeland. To leave my homeland is, this whole book is about how to leave your homeland. And so that's what he's going to do. And he, you know, here he equates it to a death. So that's also the theme of the whole book, how everything that comes to an end in our life, you know, from our lifespan itself to the end of one moment and the beginning of the next, is a kind of death. And that's what he means by dying every day, or as, you know, Marilyn has said, in talking with her, she has said, dying every second. We're really dying every second. So he chooses to do this. You know, he has this fabulous life. He does not have to walk away from this life. I mean, what a thing to do. Could we do that? We have like so much more of a humble life, really, than Mingyur Rinpoche. So many fewer perks for most of us, although we have plenty compared to many. Could we walk away? Like just give it all up and walk away? And he walked away, you know, not just from his responsibilities as abbot of the monastery. He walked away from his mother, which really broke his heart. And he walked away from his lifelong attendant, who he knew he would never see again because he was old. That's really hard. I went into 3-year retreat knowing that I probably would never see my father again. And in fact, I didn't. He died in my second year of retreat. So it's really a big deal. And as I was, and this is just me talking, but anybody else is welcome to. I think I forgot. This is going to happen more and more as I get older. I don't know what I was going to say. All right. Well, we'll go on in the book then. Anybody got anything before we do that? Yes, Lama Jinsung. Lama Jinsung, if you could unmute yourself when you're ready to speak, that would save me an unmuting.
Okay. Okay. I was going to say that although we see clearly he's removing himself physically from his so-called homeland of, you know, the monastery, it really comes down again, as we talked about in 37 Practices, that the homeland is literally just a state of mind, you know, and just removing yourself from that. So, it just reminded me of one particular sentence that I can't find now. So go on. But I mean, it's interesting because although you were stressing how he's actually removing himself physically, this book seems to be, so, you know, really what's fantastic about the book is also the fact that he's so clear about removing himself in each moment from, or finding safety in each moment by simply going back to what feels like a safe place, which is just like a set of mental delusions, you know, like I'm trying to find that one sentence, but anyway, go on. I'm sorry. That's all I had to say.
Well, I have my mental lapses. You have your page number that you can't find. You know, it's like, it's just, that's our life. It's Bardo's. It's all Bardo's. All right. So then the next passage I had marked, which I'll read a little bit of, he's talking about the advice he'd gotten from his father about just go, don't tell anybody, just go. And it'll be very good for you to do this. He says, for decades as part of the day, this is on, sorry, page XVI, the last page of the prologue. I had, for decades, as part of the daily liturgy, I had repeated, and we've all done this, right? All things are impermanent. Death comes without warning. This body, too, will be a corpse. We've all recited that so many times. The more I matured in my view, the more I intuited that I had not fully absorbed the deepest meaning of this phrase. But even so, the possibility of this impermanent body becoming a corpse without my realizing my aspirations had never strayed far from my concerns. I had waited a long time to do this retreat, waited until it became a do or die proposition, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say do and die. I would be leaving behind everything I knew with no more certainty of what might come next than if I were on my deathbed. So like he's bringing, you know, bring it on impermanence, like bring it on in the, like the most drastic possible way. So I'm skipping some pages. Hopefully I'll see my markings. I had marked a few passages that were just about the intensity of his experience. Yeah, I think I pretty much skipped that chapter, and I'm on page 11 at the bottom. Just the magnitude of what he was taking on, given his life, his sheltered, protected life. At the bottom of the page, I had never once bought a ticket for anything and had never had more weight in my backpack than a bottle of water, perhaps sunglasses and a hat. Now my backpack also contained two Buddhist texts that I had chosen to take on this journey. And someone asked him in one of the forums, asked him what two books, and it was Ocean of Definitive Meaning, which we're very familiar with from Lama Norlor Rinpoche teaching it, and a Dzogchen manual. So he had taken a little bit of money. Right, he'd taken a little bit of money with him. He really planned it out, in short. He'd been planning this for a long time. He'd saved a little bit of money and so forth. Let's see. I don't want to read this whole thing. Okay. All right, we're going to skip to page 15. When the train pulled in, top of the page. So we're now going to sort of descend into or share his complete disorientation and the aversion that comes up to everything he's experiencing. When the train pulled in, passengers grabbed their children, their animals, their big suitcases, their enormous cloth sacks tied with ropes and strapped around their foreheads, and pushed and shoved to get into the car. My backpack kept getting snagged and I had to lurch forward to disengage it. I'm having like flashbacks to the New York City subway. I was the last one in and began the train ride in terror, squashed flat against the door, my head, torso, and legs pressed between the door and the human bodies. I could see nothing but took note of the awful smell. So all of his senses are being assaulted. His physical body is being assaulted. All of his senses are being assaulted. And he's been so protected in his monastery. I had to open my mouth and suck in whatever air was available. For the next several minutes, I could not keep my mind from feeling overwhelmed. So what do we do when we're overwhelmed? Like, what did Mingyur Rinpoche do? So he says, just being there, like just being aware of his experience. After a few minutes on page 16, the strong energy of fear began to subside. And skipping down a little bit, I was no longer swept away by the wave and no longer felt like I was drowning. So he just let a little time pass, and that helped some. And then his practice and his training start to kick in. What I had to do was let it be. And that is like the whole message. You know, the Mahamudra path, the whole message is let go, relax, just be. So he says this a whole lot of times in this book. What I had to do was let it be. There was no point in trying to run away. The wave was there. Though I would have preferred to be somewhere else, I could now just acknowledge that and stay with the situation. So that's another piece of how we practice, is let it be as it is, and stay with it, like whatever it is. We don't try to escape. Stay with the situation, the spacious awareness and the unpleasant situation. So he's connected with his awareness. So the situation's still very unpleasant. He's not trying to get away from it. He's not replacing it with awareness. He's using his sort of plugging into like this vast spacious awareness that is our mind, that we always have accessible to us. He's making that leap to becoming aware of that in the midst of this overwhelming unpleasantness. And he can hold both. He holds both. When we stay with the reality vaster than the skies, the destructive impact of our wild and disturbed reactions automatically diminishes. But clouds or waves don't disappear. They dissolve and rise again. So you don't solve it once. You have to keep solving the same thing over and over and over. And that's a lot of what his experience is. He keeps confronting the same aversions, the same overwhelming experiences again and again and again, and he has to keep applying the same methods. With each stop of the train, people pushed their way off and more people boarded. So he goes on to describe more of his experience on the train. And then we start to get into he's really starting to dig into his experience on page 17. Does anybody have anything they'd like to say before we read that? Okay, page 17, top of the page. Their dirty clothes obscured my heart. Have we ever had that reaction? I was faulting their cracked bare feet, yet soon my own would look just as filthy. Their body odor was repellent, even though the humidity and the heat and the absence of air conditioning must have left my body smelling just as bad, for the shirt under my robe was glued to my torso with sweat. This section brings to mind for me Mother Teresa. You know, anybody who has worked with people in this situation, people who work with the homeless, people who work, you know, in the streets, people who work in hospitals and mental hospitals. This is your experience a lot of the time. And so his first reaction was that it put a barrier between him and these people. He couldn't remember like his commonality and his compassion at the beginning. Their dirty clothes obscured my heart. I thought that was just a very beautiful way of expressing what happens. Pema Chodron often talks about how we shut down in the face of unpleasant or difficult experience. So going down a couple of paragraphs, still on page 17, I didn't feel any connection with these people. Despite years of practices that activate spontaneous compassion, I had to reach back in memory for basic reminders. So here he starts to pull in, you know, his metta practice, his loving kindness practice. Everyone wants happiness. No one wants suffering. These people too have known joy and distress just like me. They too have lost loved ones. They too have known fear and kindness. They too will die, just as I will. For a few minutes, I repeated these reminders with genuine sincerity, and then aversion again resurfaced. It's a very tough situation. Just remembering, like the fact that he remembers is fabulous, because often we don't. Like we don't. He's trying to take down the barriers that have sort of spontaneously arisen between him and these people. But they keep coming back. So next page, page 18, for the next few hours. So through this process of remembering these teachings, remembering these practices that he's been so thoroughly trained in, he's 36 years old when he goes on retreat. He says, for the next few hours, I became both teacher and student, reviewing lessons as if I were back in monastery kindergarten. Where did this aversion come from? How did it arise? Did it come from my mind, from my body, or the outside world? My breathing was more shallow than usual. I intentionally slowed and deepened my breath. So he's remembering to analyze or to inquire into his experience. Like, why am I feeling this way? How am I feeling, you know, defining what he's experiencing and then looking into the origins of it. And he's also working with his breath to calm himself down and to bring himself back into the present. I intentionally slowed and deepened my breath, but my mind continued to question and comment, making judgments about every little detail. Noticing this, I understood that I had to turn my attention to the judging mind itself. So there's another instruction on our path that when something is upsetting us, we don't let ourselves get too embroiled in the situation itself, like who's to blame, for example, or just, you know, reinforcing our reactions. Oh my God, this is so terrible. Oh, that smells terrible, or whatever it is. But you turn to look at
where that reaction is coming from, looking at your own mind. So this is all about how we practice the wisdom paramita. You know, it's all part of the path to cultivating wisdom and compassion. So noticing this, I understood that I had to turn my attention to the judging mind itself. Are my reactions true? Are my assumptions correct? Where did they come from? I was asking myself questions that my tutor had asked me at the beginning of my first three-year retreat. So anybody had any kinds of experiences like this where you just completely lose the thread of practice because the experience is so overwhelming? Yes, Dave.
Yeah.
not long ago, perhaps?
Only like minute by minute. I've been working a lot with like I did the Joy of Living Level 3, which is Mingyur Rinpoche's insight course.
Yeah.
And I've been working with that a lot. And so it seems to me like so there's the different ways of dealing with the negative emotions there, but with the insight way, he's like looking at it and just like he's doing here, you know, like you can look at the stuff, but you can't do it, or at least I can't quite yet do it at the same time, but I can do it like really close after.
Mm-hmm.
But so, and there's, you know, all the different techniques with that. But one of the things when we saw him in California, he was doing teachings, and one thing really stuck with my, you know, with me on that. It's very simple. He was saying, if you look at like, so the things carrying you away are the river, right? Like the river of your experience, especially heavy emotions. And he's like, as soon as you can look at the river, you're no longer in the river.
Yeah.
So that was that. Yes. Just like, you know, because you have to get these really simple things to keep you when you lose it all. You know?
Yeah, and that's what he did. He went back to like kindergarten, right? And so that's a really great analogy, the river. And those are the stages. Remember the three stages of shamatha, of shine. We've studied those. We studied those in the 37 practices a little bit. Like, you could apply this to any experience and your relationship to it. First, it's like a waterfall. Like, that's the complete overwhelm. And then as you start to get a grip, which he gets through questioning it and through working with his breathing and through expanding his awareness, it becomes like a river. And you're in the river. It's slowed down a little bit, but you're in the river. And what I've read about that is that the next phase is like the river is just a slower version of the waterfall. But the next phase is when it's like you're on the bank of the river and you're looking at the river from outside. So, and then we get to the, you know, the calm lake or ocean. Yes. Lama Jinsan, can you unmute yourself?
Sorry. Okay. I put my hand up because I don't want to. I also found another lesson for within these few pages in terms of advice was 17 in the italics. You know, it was my dream after all, and it was the dream I had chosen. But in italics, it says, I don't have to like this dream. Just let it be. Don't get stuck in it. Let it take care of myself. And I bring this up because I've been noticing myself, you know, I've been having certain dreams recently where I was really aware that I was like of doing something physically. Like usually I remember my dreams, but it's sort of more of a passive kind of experience. But in this dream, I remember I was like pulling like a roll of sticker kind of things to cover something up. And then the pictures, well, anyway, they didn't, but the point is I had an experience that I was very close to of actually doing something physically. And so, it really woke me up, as it were, to this idea of, you know, and of course it was in, you know, one of those anxiety dreams. It wasn't anything pleasant. But that this idea of not resisting anymore, like what happens. And so I'm down at my dad's right now visiting him, and thankfully he's okay. But as you can see, well, he's got this little pool. And so I was in it this morning on noodles, sort of doing my little thing. And I started getting like, you know, I have like reflux going on, you know, it's like whatever. And I started in this moment really going like, you know, this really is like a dream. Like I really saw from like that experience in this recent dream, like 2 days ago, of doing something physically, but really, what is the difference between waking state and dream state? And also this idea, like he's saying with it, like the reflux, forgive me for bringing it up, where it says, I don't have to like this dream, but at the same time, instead of, again, saying, I don't like this, I don't want this, it was just, right, let it be, welcoming it. And I kept going, like, welcome, come along, you know, really opening up to, you know, this is not a bad thing. Yes, it's all a dream, and allowing, you know, the waves are moving. But so for me, in this particular section, that spoke out to me of, I don't have to like the dream, but I can let it be. I don't have to push it away. I don't have to. And so don't get stuck in it. Let it take care of itself. And when I was able to just sort of welcome it and just go, oh, okay, here you are, it did take care of itself. Not to say the sensation necessarily went away, but all of that mishigas of thoughts, yeah, about it being bad and everything. And it's like, it is just like a dream, and I don't have to like the dream, but I also don't have to dislike it either. So anyway, I found, yeah, that was a very important little instruction for me in this, yeah, section as well.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that into it.
I'll mute,
yeah,
myself.
We don't have to like it. It's not about making ourselves happy. It's not about having a feeling of pleasure. It's about detaching yourself from that kind of judgment, really, and knowing that things are just going to roll along however they're going to roll along, like when you're in a dream and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, but the last thing is this idea of accommodating for whatever happens, accepting, yeah, whatever, yeah, happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyway.
That's a good word, accommodating. Yeah, yeah, we accommodate whatever our reality is. That's a very relaxing thing. Okay, Chet and then Marilyn. Chet, you're unmuted.
Yeah, in terms of application, actually, I had taken Pema Chodron's course on death and dying, and she really goes through all the bardos and brings, yeah, home the fact that every moment is just a bardo. It's always just passing.
Yeah.
And there was something, there was like exercise in there about imagining yourself being, you know, dead and thinking about your own death and dying as part of that bardo practice. And I fly a lot for my job. And this last month I was in 4 different cities. I've been all around the country. And I think it's probably a stretch to say this, but in many ways flying now is like being on that train, you know, yeah, it's crowded.
Oh yeah.
People are harassing you, you know, yeah, there's a lot of anxiety, all that stuff. And I would really get worked up. And to confess, I used to really rely on medication to help me get through the flight. And I've really been stepping back, and I would find reactions coming up, and I would say to myself, so, you know, when I'm dead, is this really going to matter? This stuff, you know, tomorrow, going through the bardo, tomorrow, I won't remember today. You know, so all the, yeah, things that I'm worked up by tomorrow, they'll have passed, they'll be gone. They'll, yeah, just be, you know, if they're important enough, they'll be a memory. If they're not important enough, they'll just be in that garbage can of my, you know, my past.
Yes, brilliant observation. And thank you for reminding us that we could have this kind of experience anytime, like just buy a plane ticket, go to the airport, go get on the subway, go walk the streets. You could have all these unpleasant, overwhelming experiences anytime, although you would be able to get out of them pretty quickly.
If you're in a flight over, you know, someplace,
well, that's maybe the not thing. That. You are stuck.
That train in India, you're trapped.
Yeah, know? On the train, on the plane, you are stuck. That's, yeah, true. Yes. Wow. All right, Marilyn, you had something?
Well, I'll add this very briefly. I heard an interview with a woman who's written a book called something like, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs When I'm Dead? And it was all the questions she got from children. And she herself was, she worked in a crematorium. And she also mentioned that she traveled around the world, and the people in the United States have the greatest aversion to death. That any of anybody she's seen. But yeah, what I really wanted to say was that all of this is about not blaming outside for whatever we're feeling. It's all, yeah, an interiorization, not in a negative way, but in a really positive way. It's all about however you look at it. It's not like they are making me something or other.
Yeah.
That smell is making me da-da-da-da. The what, you know, and that's where that river thing comes in really well, because you can just step back. But it's all about, you know, just watching your own interior and getting enough space actually to do that. And we've got techniques, we've all been trained in them, but we got them here in the book, you know, the ABC of what to do.
Yeah. And speaking of ABCs of what to do, so we brought in the 37 practices, because this whole thing is basically the second practice, as well as all the other practices are going to be mixed in. But here we have one of the main slogans of the 7 points of mind training: drive all blame into one. You know, we're not blaming exterior circumstances or exterior people. It's not productive. It just makes it worse, because that never stops. But yes, thank you. That's another good reminder, not blaming our circumstances. Anybody else? I just had this revelation, which I didn't have when I was preparing for class, that we can take our time. Like, we can have as much discussion as we want, because we have 3 meetings before the third section of the course drops. So to do the first 2 sections, we have 3 weeks. So I don't have to get through everything in section one this week. So please don't be stinting with your comments. Yes, Lama Jinzong.
I was actually thinking that maybe that would be the way for you and I to work it, is that you would cover section one for 2 weeks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the 15th, we could say, is the since it's 30 days in a month and they've given us 2 sections for 4 weeks,
yeah,
is that we could plan on like the 15th, or what, you know, people can go ahead with section two, but that I could cover the next 2 weeks. Just, we could go through section two that way if you want to work like that.
Yeah, I think we only have, I mean, we can take our time. You know, we don't have to be synced in terms of time with the course. We only have 2 more Thursdays in September but Dream can take as long as it wants. You know, we'll see where we get. We might start Dream next week in the middle of things. Anyway, we can just play it by ear. I think that's a good suggestion.
Okay.
Good suggestion.
I have a quick one.
Yes, Mark.
I was actually, I keep getting reminded about a trip that I took, leaving a monastery and deciding that I wasn't going to take fancy transportation, mm-hmm, even though I could afford it.
Was this in India?
In India, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I took buses and a train ride. And what he describes, it's really different. It's different than the airport, for sure.
Yeah.
It's much
more intense.
Actually, like living in the bus station and in the train station. And then it's way more crowded than you'd ever believe.
Yeah. I mean, here, at least with airlines, usually there is at least a schedule that you can sort of count on somewhat.
And people do, you know, they defecate on the train tracks and things like that. So.
Well, Imogen's long is nodding. Everybody who's been to India is nodding. Yes. Okay, so maybe we can't get the intensity. I don't know where you would go to get the intensity. I guess you have to go to India or some other third world country. But we can get a little bit of it, and maybe that's better for us.
Yeah.
Like, next time we're on a flight through no choice of our own, you know, we could remember this book. Take the book with you. Do the meditations. Anybody else? Oh, yes. Dave, I'm going to unmute you. Oh, sorry, you were unmuted and now I have muted you. Now you're good. Oh, nope. You do it. We're both doing it at the same time. Oh, Cal will do it. You're now unmuted.
Okay. Just quickly, I was going to say, I used to all the senses to do the open awareness quickly. Like, you know, you can, and often you can't really have smell, because it seems like you only have smell when it's really good, or especially when it's really bad. And smell is really connected to like the lizard brain. So it's really powerful when you get it. So I was on the BART train in California, and I hadn't done it in a while. It was a late night, and there was a car where there's a lot of seats available, so that usually means something's up.
Yeah. New York is similar. Case, indeed,
there was a heavy, you know, urine smell there. Mm. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. I'll sit here and I'll continually get this and I'll try to use this for the awareness meditation. It was pretty intense. So
yeah,
there, you do have the opportunity here to get that.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole theme of like, of the first section of Mingyur Rinpoche's course is like, bring it on, you know, use it. Yeah. Don't avoid it. Use it. We can use it and welcome it. Welcome like all these things as an opportunity to practice and to prepare for sort of the ultimate bardos of this life of dying. Okay. Thank you, Dave. Anybody else? Yes. Deidre.
So my biggest practice happened on the back of a motorcycle because there's no getting off and, you know, looking at death every second, like, oh, there's a death. Oh, that could have been a death. Like some of the roads are pretty wild and then people are texting while they're driving and I go by and I see them. It was really good practice for me. I probably did most of my really deep meditation on the back of a motorcycle or on the Autobahn going at 85 right. miles an hour.
So this was recently? This was when you were in Europe recently?
Yeah, this was kind of ongoing.
Ah, okay. So you're back whenever in California now. You're
I'm in California now? Yeah, okay. But there's a motorcycle in every place where my husband is. So wherever we go, there is a motorcycle and there is that experience. And I have to say the other thing that where I had no idea at all of making it a practice or of looking at anything at that moment was the moment that I saw that Trump was elected. Uh-huh. I immediately went into meditation of the wisdom paramita, like immediately because I think when something happens that is just so off the charts, it was that kind of Zen moment where I just saw how everything was. And I was actually kind of grateful for that experience, you know, and then lastly, the other thing is about the smells and things, which has happened also on the road, is doing the taking and sending rather than the aversion is welcoming it, especially pollution, auto pollution.
Yes.
Industrial pollution.
That's a tough one.
Through fires and
Well, what a great opportunity for attitude adjustment.
Yes, I think, you know, almost not living in a monastery with all the protections that it affords really is, there's so many more things to practice with.
If you've ever lived in a monastery, I'm going to have to laugh.
Well, I've been in
but
New
in
York
terms
a
of
lot.
Like, yeah.
I've been in New York a lot, and I know that there is a lot of stuff there as well.
Yeah.
But I think you take all that stuff and add on all the other samsara stuff.
Yeah. But being in an enclosed situation, too, has an intensity of practice sometimes, intensity of interpersonal relationships, say 3-year retreat, for example, the intensity of it, you may not have like the sensory, you know, whole sensory overwhelm, but you can get overwhelmed a different way. You can get some really intense situations to work with. So I think they're both like, they're, you know, I get your point, but I think also in a monastery, there's plenty to work with too. And I just wanted to say, since we did have a slight introduction of politics, which was fine because you were, you know, it's a personal experience, whichever side of the fence you're on, you could have that with something that happens politically. All right. Anybody else before we continue on with the book?
Marilyn had Marilyn had her hand up.
Okay. I'm going to unmute John and then Marilyn. John, you'll have to unmute yourself.
Okay.
You got it.
Yeah. So, let me do a quick example of recent, a few weeks ago before I even read this, you know, started reading on this, but, I had some dentist appointments and, it was the beginning of a week and someone asked me on the end of the week, how was your week? I said, well, Monday started with a root canal and it went pretty much continued from there. But my point is that I said, when they were ready to put a crown on, I said, I asked to not get a shot of Novocaine. And the dentist was like, oh, you don't want to do that. And I'm like, well, I kind of told her, yeah, I did. And she said, but she gave me, what do you call it, like Ambisol or something silly. And just to experience it. And then even in the meditation group, people are like, well, why would you do that? And at the time it was like hard to explain exactly, but I wanted, like what you said, just bring it on.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to be put in a situation where I'm out of my comfort zone and see what's happening in my mind. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
And how did it go? Was it, you survived, obviously.
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, I read, I can't remember if it was Tulku Orjan or Trungurin, but they had eye surgery once with no anesthesia because the anesthesiologist messed up and he endured the whole thing and they didn't even know until he told them afterwards that he felt everything. So that's like where your practice can take you. So that's a good beginning. Dental work with no anesthesia. All right, Marilyn. Whoops. Okay, you're unmuted.
I just wanted to add that if you're a woman in India, you have the blessings of the women's car in a train.
Oh.
If you've got that, take it.
Really? Yeah, I see Kathy giving a thumbs up there or something. Yeah. Okay, well, that's good to know. All right, well, we're going to go on with the book only because we just have 25 minutes left and I do want to get to the meditation. But we're going to fast forward to that. Didn't feel any connection with these people here on page 17. So he, right, and then page 18, where he went back to kindergarten. So he's just working with the most primary, rudimentary level of his teachings that he's had all his life. And so now we're going to fast forward to, page 20. And this is a practice. I mean, we're not in the midst of, all of this right now, but he says, do not run away from these unpleasant feelings. Do not manipulate them into pleasant feelings. So all of these, it applies to all of these things that we've been discussing. Stay with what is, with whatever arises. Now is your time to stand at the edge and watch the water flow by. That's Dave's example of the river. Just watch without getting caught in the current. So maybe that's the most we can hope for, is just to take ourselves out of that immediate, like being swept away feeling. Just get to the edge, just disengage a little bit. So I think I'm skipping the next chapter, Born with a Silver Spoon, which is largely about Mingyur Rinpoche's background, his life. And then we're into Impermanence and Death, chapter 4. We're getting very close to some meditation. Okay. So on the bottom of page 29, so he's still on the train. I lowered my gaze, straightened my back. So he's on the train. He's now going into sort of meditation mode. I lowered my gaze, straightened my back, and asked, what am I feeling right now? That would be a key question when we're feeling any kind of overwhelm or disorientation. Like, don't be disconnected from your feelings. That's what we do at the beginning of classes, is like, how is my body feeling right now? And you could say, how is my mind feeling? We forget to notice that. So how am I feeling right now? A key question to start to bring ourselves out of it, because if you can identify it, you're on the riverbank, I think. If you can say, oh, I'm really angry right now, you're on the riverbank looking at yourself being angry, even if you're still consumed by it. So he says, my entire body felt racked by tension. I engaged in a body scan, an exercise I often do at night once I lie down to sleep. So that's something we could do on a daily basis too. I brought my attention to the top of my head and worked down very slowly, lingering to loosen specific knots. And then further down to the middle of the page, I spent about 10 minutes going from top to bottom. So it's just nice to know, what is Mingyur Rinpoche's way of practicing? How does he end his day? I spent about 10 minutes going from top to bottom. Then I just rested for several more minutes, feeling less agitated than I had for hours. So a theme of his like the way he teaches and obviously practices in meditation is he will apply a method. You know, he'll do an inquiry or he'll do a body scan or he'll follow the breath, like whatever it takes to get disengaged from what's overwhelming you in this case, or just from the busyness of your mind, if it's more normal circumstance. And then he rests in open awareness. So we apply the method, but he really, his, you know, his instruction is based in accustoming ourselves to open awareness. So he spent 10 minutes doing the body scan, then he rested for several more minutes. So I just found that an interesting window into his practice. And then on page 34, skipping far ahead to page 34 at the bottom, end of the chapter, I was dying now on this train, having started this journey. I was dying to my old life. And he makes the point that he's chosen to do this. So now we're going to do some of the meditation. Chapter 5 has two lengthy meditations in it. We'll see what we can do. But these are just examples of how we can practice. So first on page 35, the first page of Letting Wisdom Arise, bottom of the page. Actually the top of the page. Once we move from the belief that things are unchanging, and so this brings us actually to the Dying Every Day course, that the practice of the Dying Every Day course, both in daily life and on the cushion, is to tune into impermanence, the most basic teaching of the Buddha. So he says, once we move from the belief that things are unchanging to the experience that everything is transitory, the tension between our expectations and reality as it is begins to dissolve. Then we can know that the disturbance of this moment will pass, and that if we stay with recognition of awareness, the problem will transform on its own. And that comes back to what Lama Jinzong was saying about just, you know, take yourself out of unpleasant, pleasant. It's, you can't control the experience, so you just roll with it. And the problem will transform on its own. It doesn't need any help from us in order to move on. The inherent nature of everything is change. It's our preoccupation with a problem that nails it in place. Yet leaving it be is easier said than done. And I think that's something we all know very well. We are not familiar with abiding in the non-conceptual aspects of our minds and staying with our direct experience. We are so used to identifying with our ideas of who we are and merging our identities with people and places and with objects such as our cars and houses. These are all, these things, you know, our car, our house, our job, our friends, these all go into our concept of who we are, our sort of, you know, false identity. We are so used to identifying with all of these things that the experience of the natural mind liberated from all this familiar matter can be frightening. It can be misinterpreted as a nothingness. I'm going to skip now. What can be most helpful here is to lightly rest the mind on the qualities of awareness. Emptiness and spacious awareness have qualities of cognizance or knowingness. This is not nothingness. In the same way that the breath can support awareness practice, qualities of spacious awareness can themselves support resting the mind in non-conceptual states. Because my So here we're getting into the meditation. So let's just get ourselves into meditation mode. Did anybody have anything they wanted to say before we do this? Okay, so meditation mode, checking in with our posture, making sure that we're relaxed and alert. He says, I decided that the most reliable exercise for steadying the mind in the midst of circumstances that were being experienced as aversive was probably a simple awareness meditation. The idea is to gather the distracted mind by placing it lightly on one sense object. So here he's not talking about beginning with open awareness because we're trying to bring our mind to rest. You can do that through open awareness, but if you're really overwhelmed, that would be really hard. So he picks one sense, and you could pick any sense, but he picks sound. Well, the idea is to gather the distracted mind by placing it lightly on one sense object. Because I had been agitated by sounds, I chose sound as the object. So if it was smell, like on that BART car, you could pick smell. But here it's sound, because he's been very disturbed. Remember the sound of the train. The train whistle has totally unnerved him. So he picks sound. This awareness practice uses sound as support for meditation. The object supports our recognition of awareness, but does not remain the focus of it. So it's not about like zeroing in on sound and like having all your attention on that. It's focusing on sound as a way of opening your awareness completely. It's a support for open awareness in the end. Because even while you're doing sound meditation, you might start off like strongly attentive to the sound, but you're letting go of that because you want all of your senses to be open. You want that sense of spaciousness and emptiness around you. So the object supports our recognition of awareness. It helps us recognize awareness, but it does not remain the focus of it. We don't stay with it. So for about 1 minute, I took stock of all the different sounds around me. So let's do that. We may not have a predominant sound right now. We may not even have much sound, but let's just take a moment and just notice all the sounds that are around us without making it a tight awareness. We can be noticing other things too, but all the sound. Then I selected the most dominant, the grinding chug of the train's wheel. So if you have a dominant sound, sometimes there could be a lawnmower going or a plane flying overhead or some irritating sound in your vicinity or some nice sound in your vicinity. If there isn't a predominant sound, then we'll just stay open to all sound. But if there is a predominant sound, you could focus on that. I directed my mind to rest lightly on this sound. And then he has a series of instructions. So we're just going to work with each of those. First, be with the sound. Just be present to the sound. And that can take a little time. He only spent a minute, but we can take a little time. Be present with all the sound we can hear or with a particular sound. No commentary. We're not thinking about the sound or judging the sound. We're just being present to it. Befriend the sound. So if the sound is unpleasant, we're opening our heart to it. We're letting go of any resistance we may have to it. So be with the sound. These are all concurrent instructions. Be with the sound, no commentary. Befriend the sound. Let the thoughts, the fears, the stress drain out into the sound. We may not have sounds that are causing those problems, but if we have any kind of distress that we're feeling right now, physical discomfort, anything that's upsetting us mentally that perhaps we've put on hold for the class, we can be with that too and let it channel itself into the sound. Use just this sound to gather the mind. It's just letting our attention settle into this sound. Letting all of our hopes and fears, all of our distress, all of our tensions, settle into this awareness of sound. If thoughts come, that's okay. Just let them go. Let them come and go. They are clouds passing through. If our attention is momentarily diverted to a thought or an emotion, then just return to the object, which is simply resting in awareness of sound. And the final instruction is rest. So he says, after about 5 minutes, I withdrew my mind from the object, the chugging sound, and allowed my awareness to remain open, to let my mind acknowledge various sounds, the wheels, coughing, talking, but alighting on none of them. So he says, we call this open awareness or shamatha without object. So I think at this point, he's letting go of even being particularly present to sound now. If it's open awareness, we're present to all the senses. So if our eyes are open, we can be aware of light and color and shape in our visual field, aware of sounds, aware of any tactile sensations, internal, external, smells if there are any, tastes if there are any. Let it be. Whatever arises, let it be. Stay with awareness. Notice the sound arising within the recognition of awareness. So we could apply this to any sensory input, anything that's arising to our senses right now. Keep the focus on awareness. Don't lose touch with the awareness that the sound is arising within, or the sensory perception is arising within. Do not go toward it, whatever the sensory perception is. Do not withdraw from it. Do not pick and choose. Stay aware, rest. So we can continue to do that for just another minute or so. Just resting with whatever presents itself to our senses, not moving towards or favoring one perception and pushing away another, but just letting it all be. So now back to his narrative. Soon enough, sounds that had been disturbing became soothing. So he felt a transformation in his reaction to the sensory stimulus. After about 20 minutes, and I think this is very important, it wasn't instantaneous. It's a process that we have to let unfold. It may not happen in the first minute or the first 5 minutes or even the first 10 minutes, especially if we're dealing with some kind of strong perception or strong reaction. He didn't notice it change for about 20 minutes. After about 20 minutes, I was able to get some distance between myself and my unease. My expanded sense of self grew bigger than the problem. It was able to accommodate the negative reaction to sound within a larger sphere. So he had opened up his awareness beyond his reactivity, so that I was no longer the exact size and shape of my discomfort. The unease was still there. It didn't disappear. He's not, you know, it's not eradicated, but I was no longer trapped inside it. So that's very beautiful. And Lama Jinzong has mentioned that too, because you've talked about this. I was no longer the exact size and shape of my discomfort. Did you have anything you wanted to say about that, Lama Jinzong?
And just, I found this particular passage to be so profound because it becomes everything, whatever our negativity is, suddenly that's all we are. You know, it's the feeling of negativity, and that it completely defines, that's my experience of it. And, you know, so to say it, I was no longer the exact size and shape of my discomfort. I was no longer trapped inside of it. I just think is a very profound way of expressing.
It's really true. Evocative. Like, it's really the way it feels. Like, you are contracted around it. When we're really upset or overwhelmed, there's a contraction that's taking place. So we could use this. Like, we could use this as a basis for our meditation or our, you know, navigating the world. This is a really good, fruitful method. And especially the lack of expectation. It's not an instant cure. It takes time for your mind to let go. And then it's going to come back again, probably. So we let go again. You just have to have the patience and the joyful diligence, the joyful perseverance to keep working at it. So I'm going to end. I wanted to just talk a tiny bit about the dying every day material, because for anyone who's not taking that course, there's a couple of really useful things that we can practice with for the next week. But I just want to read this next couple of sentences, because this is the basic antidote. Awareness is the essence of our existence. It is within our reach all the time, and yet most of us do not recognize that. So we go for awareness. That's what it is. It's like when you are the exact shape and size of whatever is bothering you, what you do is you open your awareness. You reconnect with that vast awareness that is the nature of our mind. We're going to find eventually in our practice, if we haven't already found it, that that is the nature of our mind. That's the nature of reality. And we can touch in with that anytime. And the key is just to remember that you can open it up. And in Pema Chidren's course on the six realms, I think it was last year, she said realms are really like when you're caught in an emotional state to that extent, like that it defines you. You can't get out of it. It is exactly your shape and size, or you the shape and size of it. And she suggests that the way to touch in with awareness and expand, you know, your awareness in those moments is if you can feel your feet on the ground and feel the space around you. And I think that's a really useful instruction. So we're going to stop here in the book on page 37 and come back to it next week. And if anybody like wants to reread any of this and reread through page 52, we can talk, you know, you can bring in like whatever most resonated with you next week. So I just wanted to take a moment. I have my my little binder here with the Dying Every Day course. And so the view is summarized in just a couple of sentences. We'll talk more about this next week. We'll finish going through this section of the book with discussion, and we'll talk more about the course itself. So whether you're taking the course or not, I think everyone will benefit from it. So the key points of the view in this section, so first of all, he talks about all six bardos, and there's going to be a section on each bardo, and each section is allotted about a week in the live course, which ends sometime in October. And so the first section is the bardo of this life. It's the first of the bardos, and that is from the time we're born until the time we enter the bardo of death. And two of the other bardos are included in the bardo of this life, which are the bardo of meditation and the bardo of dream. And the next section is the bardo of dream, where we learn how to work with the dream state a little bit. And then meditation will come in October. So the key points for the bardo of this life, like how to work with this life. Fear of death leads to suppression and denial, which amplifies and magnifies the fear. So it's talking about death, and dying every day. You know, he's dying to his life. He's, you know, that's what we're afraid of, is dying to our identity, you know, dying to who we are. So that's what he's choosing to do in this book. And it comes out of fear. So fear of dying leads to suppression and denial, which amplifies and magnifies the fear. So that's counterproductive if we just try to ignore it or suppress it. So what do we do instead? That's the second point of the view. Accepting the impermanence of this life allows us to let go and relax. So we could spend the next week really noticing impermanence. You could reread Gampopa on impermanence and remember how he instructs us to remain aware of impermanence through this daily cycle of day to night, through the changing of the seasons, and through moment to moment change. We could become aware of those. So first of all, like really tuning into impermanence will really help us deal with the fear of death. And then remembering that the process of dying is a great opportunity to learn and grow, even a great adventure. And that's a major theme of this section. And then through this practice, we can see the luminous, free, clear nature of mind, which is open and vast like the sky. So through noticing impermanence and through beginning to look at the process of letting go and dying as also an opportunity for rebirth and adventure, it also connects us with the nature of our own mind. So this is ultimately a nature of mind practice. So that's the view. You don't have to remember that particularly, but I wanted to read you what the practice is. The main practice for this section, the Bardo of this life, is as you sit in meditation, and I will email this information for anybody that doesn't have it. Be aware of your breath going in and out. It's basic breath meditation, but with like a little more depth to it. So be aware of your breath going in and out and notice how your experience of the breath is changing moment by moment. So we're now using meditation on the breath, which is a very basic technique of meditation, to tune into impermanence. How does my body change as I'm breathing? And he actually has a nice description of, you know, the lungs expand and, you know, the oxygen goes throughout the body and then turns into carbon dioxide and, you know, comes back and we breathe it out. But just notice even, you know, your abdomen and your lungs, your chest are rising and falling, for example, or you feel a sensation at your nostrils and so forth. Notice how your experience of the breath is changing moment by moment. And also notice how the body is changing. We're breathing, pumping blood, even there's subtle change at the cellular level. And I have to say that I found this meditation really, really opened something up for me. Like to be aware of impermanence in the outer world, and then at the same time to become aware of impermanence in the inner world, it really broke down. Like that breaks down a barrier for me. Something a little bit towards non-dual awareness, perhaps. Anyway, I found this a very powerful meditation. I will email it. And then in our daily life, sorry, I'm a little bit over time, but we're right at the end. In our daily life practice, notice how emotions change, how they go up and down. So instead of being totally caught in an emotion, we can just wait it out and notice how it changes when we're in an emotional state. Look for the gap between past and present. Try to remember 3 times a day to let go and be in the present with whatever you're experiencing. So 3 times a day, just let go and be in the present moment. And also when you're facing a problem, big or small, and again, I will email this, notice the flux and flow of daily life. Notice the ups and downs and be present. This is in the context of a particular problem, a particular issue, a particular discomfort. Notice the ups and downs. Notice the changing nature of that experience and plan ahead. Find a specific situation in which to apply this teaching each day this week. So that's a lot to work with, actually. So anyway, does anybody have any comments before we do our dedication? Anything else? Yes, Dave, you are unmuted.
Just a quick on the impermanence thing. A lot of times when I do the 4 thoughts, that seems a bit stick as opposed to carrot for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you better think about this or you're going to, you know. The impermanence and death, if you think about impermanence like this, it's more of a carrot and less of a stick. If I meditate, I'll be more able to enjoy the impermanence rather than be scared by it.
I really like his tweak on it too, that like we don't have to focus only on something coming to an end. We can shift our focus to something beginning. Like, so there's the gap and you don't know necessarily what's coming next. And instead of having a fear, you could tune into like a sense of adventure. And that's like a shift we can make on purpose. Like it can be contrived. This is where we can contrive. And it's really helpful to focus on the sort of positive instead of as we reflexively do the negative. Yes, Lama Jinzong. Oops.
Myself. So this is why one of my favorite sentences, 51, you don't have to turn to it now, but it says, this is the Bardo stages then illuminate how these iconic death to life transitions emerge in everyday experience. And I was like, right on, because instead of always thinking life to death, dying, he puts it reverse. He says death to life, which, you know, this is what it's about. Yeah.
Very helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else before we close? Okay, I'm going to, Dan, did you have something? Okay, I'm going to mute everybody who's not muted. And find my prayers. There. Okay, and well, let's bring our minds to rest again. Just letting everything settle. You could tune into the body again. How do I feel in this present moment? What am I feeling right now? Maybe tuning into the impermanence of everything around us and everything inside us. Things constantly shifting and moving and ending and beginning. And then noticing that vast awareness that we can touch into whenever we're feeling claustrophobic about something. And we're going to share this benefit, the benefit of having had this teaching from Ingyur Rinpoche with all sentient beings by doing the dedication. This merit, may it win omniscience. Defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu Zangpo and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And I'm going to add to the Teregar's suggestions for how to practice this week. Maybe we could look for an opportunity this week before we meet again, maybe daily, maybe just one time even, to really immerse ourselves in a situation that we find unpleasant, to really open ourselves to it and welcome it. See, just experiment with what that would feel like, just letting down the barriers and letting go of our resistance to something. And practicing with awareness in this way. So I'm going to unmute everybody. You're unmuted. So thanks everybody for participating in the discussion. It was great. Lama Jinzong, you had something?
Well, you know, this is very much what the Teregar course is, that they really do encourage people to have small forums, groups to talk together. And we see the benefit of being able to really share the reading and just, I'm just grateful to everyone for being involved.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody's insights are really, really appreciated. So we will, I'll send out an email and I will see everybody again next week.
Chidra, do you want to stay on a second?
Oh, sure.
You and I, and then we'll talk.
Everyone can just see themselves to the door today. Bye, Dave. Good to see you, Dave.
Yeah, up and lucid.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, Joanne. Good to see you. Well, not see you, but you know that you were here.
Bye, everybody. Bye.